Good afternoon, and welcome to our virtual lecture series. I'm Betsy Cannon-Smith, class of 84, sitting here in Amherst on a beautiful sunny day, and it's my pleasure to introduce you to Frank Cuvarez, the E. Dwight Salmon Professor of History and American Studies. Today he'll be speaking to us on 9/11 in History and Memory. Professor Cuvarez received his BA from the University of Pittsburgh and his MA and PhD in History from the University of Michigan. He's been a member of the Amherst faculty since 1983. His current work is in the history of free speech and censorship. He published in 1996 an edited collection of essays entitled Movie Censorship and American Culture, and he is the author of Interpretations of American History, Patterns and Perspectives, with fellow faculty member Martha Saxton. He teaches courses in 19th and 20th century U.S. social and cultural history, as well as in American Studies, and is currently chair of the American Studies Department. This semester, he's teaching a first-year seminar with 15 students called Drugs and History, and an American Studies course called The Embodied Self in American Culture and Society. Professor Cuvarez also serves on the college's Mental Health Task Force as a facilitator for campus intergroup dialogues and as a member of the Committee on Education and Athletics. To top it off, he has also served as a first-year dean at the college. To submit a question during this call, please send an email to alumseries, that's A-L-U-M-S-E-R-I-E-S, alumseries, at amherst.edu. And at the conclusion of Professor Cabarrus's remarks, we'll try to get to as many of your questions as possible. A recording of this call will also be posted on the alumni website later this week, and we hope you'll join us for our October 21st lecture at 4 p.m. with Professor Monica Ringer on the Arab Spring, Lessons from Iran. But let's now turn it over to Professor Cuvarez. Thank you for joining us this afternoon, and we're very much looking forward to your remarks.
Thank you. And thank you all out there. In the old days, we would have said in radio land, out there at the other end of the phones. I appreciate your being here. I'm especially impressed that 93 names are on this list of people who might be at the other end of the phone line. And I'm especially happy to see names I recognize, former thesis students like Adam Gonzalez, who wrote a wonderful thesis with me on Mexican-American workers in Chicago, and Alexandra Linden, who wrote a wonderful thesis on Hungarian refugees from 1956, and Kate Mooney, who wrote a terrific thesis on Texas swing and the Great Depression that was really memorable, and I and others, Rachel Spear, who wrote a terrific thesis on the evolution in the schools of Arkansas. So it's great to see those names from the past and the names of some people who must be the parents of my students, because there aren't that many Dres Pools, for example, a wonderful student who is my advisee right now. So for all of you out there who decided to spend an hour or so with me, I thank you, and I hope you'll find it edifying. So I prepared some comments, and they begin with memory, with my memory of what happened very soon after the attack on the towers and on the Pentagon on 9/11, specifically what happened when I set foot in class on the day after the attacks. So let me read my comments, and then I'd be very happy to hear from you and your questions. When the plane struck the first towers, I was at home on my way out the door, heading for my office at Amherst College. I was just about to turn off the radio as NPR's Morning Edition ended its broadcast, when things changed suddenly. The announcer said a plane had struck the World Trade Center, so I immediately turned on the TV to see the terrible spectacle, and within minutes, the second plane struck. I kept watching until the inconceivable occurred. Right before my eyes, one of the flaming towers collapsed like an accordion. A little while later, the second followed suit. This is the first thing I remember when I remember the 9/11 attack. The second is my class the next day. The course, America in the 20th Century, was brand new and in its second week. I was supposed to talk about immigrants and cities at the turn of the century. But obviously, there was only one possible topic that day. I told the class we could talk about what happened in any way they chose, and questions began almost immediately. The first, and one that seemed to repeat itself in different guises over and over again, was, why do they hate us? To this, I had no well-conceived answer, but I did what historians usually do. I talked about the history of U.S. relations in the Middle East. I promised the class that I would find something by an expert to read in the later days of the course, but for now suggested that the U.S. had made some unwise choices that helped to explain, but of course not in no way justified, this explosion of hatred. The other question that recurred that day was, what should the U.S. do in response to these attacks? Here, an interesting gender division appeared. All but one of the women who spoke said, we need to understand the answer to the first question and then figure out how to reduce the hatred. Almost all the men said, strike back. I don't remember everything that was said on that morning, but these two responses stand out. And after a decade, it appears to me that my students asked the best questions that anyone has asked about those tragic events. Why? And now what? Our leaders and pundits have offered scores of answers over the years, some of them pretty simple-minded or wrong-headed or worse, but none has come up with better questions. Politicians and pundits began in the wake of 9/11 to declare that, as a result of the attacks, quote, everything is different, unquote. Somehow that event, like a new Pearl Harbor, would rewrite the foreign policy playbook, turning the confusion of the post-Cold War era into the clarity of a global struggle between good and evil, between freedom and terrorism. President Bush and his advisors in particular took the event as a warrant to conduct aggressive military action, not just in Afghanistan, where most Americans and most of our allies thought we had a right and a mandate to act, but also later in Iraq. He and his advisors believed that this event would finally erase the Vietnam syndrome and launch the U.S. into an era in which it would wield its unilateral power with confidence and daring to bring freedom, which meant not just democracy, but also capitalism, to the benighted world. The disastrous consequences of that hubris, in particular the consequences of the invasion of Iraq, are now evident, but Bush and his team, and a very compliant press, convinced most Americans in 2003 that somehow a dictator who had always been hated by Osama bin Laden and who had pursued al-Qaeda agents ruthlessly in his own country was somehow linked to the 9/11 attack and deserved to suffer for it. Meanwhile, as we've also come to know, Osama slipped away beyond the hills of Tora Bora and into the mountains of Pakistan. Historians don't generally come up with explicit policy recommendations, but we like to believe that we offer a sense of context in which to make better policy choices. Of course, historians are political animals like everybody else, so each historian's contextual wisdom comes with a spin. But even after acknowledging that, it's fair to say that most of us believe, most of us historians believe, that the proliferation of contexts, even highly different and unharmonious ones, cannot help but equip citizens and politicians with sharper tools with which to analyze their world and make decisions about it. So what have historians been saying about 9/11? That depends, of course, again, on what kind of history they write and from what perspective. But it's fair to say that almost all of them reject the everything is different argument. Most of them have identified as many continuities as discontinuities in U.S. foreign policy since 9/11. Indeed, some argue that nothing has changed, except perhaps, possibly if we're lucky, that we might take advantage of a new opportunity to attend to policy errors that led us to the current crisis. Roughly speaking, historians' responses break down into one of the following types. First, there are historians of war and diplomacy who trace the origins of U.S. relations in the Middle East to several powerful tendencies in American foreign policy. Some emphasize oil and its central position within the strategic interests of the U.S. in the 20th century. of these historians. Some treat America's insistence that it must have access to Middle Eastern oil as the fairly unproblematic assertion by a great industrial power of an obvious strategic interest. Others see oil as the snake in the garden, the corrupter of a foreign policy and of a republic based on constitutional law, of a foreign policy that might have managed conflicts in the Middle East in more even-handed, less interventionist ways, had it not been for the failure of American policymakers to control the nation's voracious appetite for petroleum. The former treat the actions of foreigners seeking control over their own resources and their own political future as threats to American economic security and therefore as challenges to American foreign policy. The latter treat the actions of American policymakers and citizens as the key behaviors that brought on a spiral of increasingly hostile relations. A second group of historians traces the hatred of the U.S. to Muslim fury over America's support for Israel. Many of these see support for this democratic ally as necessary and even noble, and see the rage of Muslims, especially Palestinians, as the product of manipulation by undemocratic leaders. Some go farther still, borrowing from Samuel Huntington the notion of a clash of civilizations, and arguing that because of its lack of an enlightenment, Islam cannot break out of its theocratic straitjacket, and therefore can never live peacefully in a world of multicultural diversity. Other historians discount such Manichaean analyses, focusing instead on more proximate causes of Muslim suspicion of the U.S. In particular, these historians think that America wears the straitjacket, one created by its uncritical support for Israel. These historians explain such support as a response to A, the post-World War II sympathy for the victims of Nazism, B, the power of the Jewish lobby in the U.S., C, to the need of U.S. policymakers in the Cold War to find a stable ally in an unstable region. They argue that because the U.S. has made a fetish of stability, it has unwisely given uncritical support not only to Israel, but also to Saudi Arabia and several other unpopular regimes in the Gulf. In the post-Cold War era, terrorism has replaced communism, these historians argue, as the enemy. But the strategic obsession with stability remains, and it continuously manufactures enemies of the United States. Another group of historians focuses not on the causes, but on the means of terrorism. These scholars of globalization see 9/11 as significant because it's the first clear demonstration that non-state actors possess new means of powerfully affecting great states in the global era. These historians do indeed believe that something important is different in the current era, but that something is a cause and not a consequence of 9/11. Terrorists have converted key elements of globalization, the commercial airliner, the cell phone, the credit card, the internet, and international television coverage into weapons of mass destruction. Enraged political sectarians have always existed, and they have regularly committed acts of terror, assassinations, bombings, arson, sabotage, but most of these have had local and partial impact on the world. A few, like the assassin who killed Archduke Franz Ferdinand, brought on the First World War, but generally, terror has local and partial impact. Arab resentment of American support for Israel and for Gulf dictatorships is not new. But what is new now is that instruments of global interconnection have turned garden variety terrorists into world historical actors. So when we ask historians about 9/11, we get few simple answers to our basic questions, why and what now? But we do get several cautionary notes that might help us understand why the political reaction to 9/11, which at first seemed so emotionally clear and uncomplicated, led to an interminable engagement in Afghanistan and an almost as extended and largely unsuccessful engagement in Iraq. We might have done better had we paid more attention to the question my students asked on that September 12th morning in 2001. Why do they hate us? Saying it's because they're fanatics or uncivilized doesn't help much. That answer stops inquiry rather than inviting it. The current upheavals in the Middle East might encourage Americans to listen again to those historians who show how U.S.-supported dictators have regularly frustrated the aspiration of the Arab street. On the question of U.S. support for negotiations between Palestine and Israel, options are far more limited. Even the harshest critics of U.S.-Israeli alliance acknowledge that the U.S. can never leave Israel vulnerable to its enemies. And yet the reality that negotiated settlements have been reached in the past cannot be dismissed either. When the U.S. has thrown its weight into negotiations, some kind of two-state solution appears more likely, and therefore so does the shrinking of Palestinians' rage over their statelessness and Israelis' fear over their vulnerability to terrorism. We might also acquire from history a renewed sense of the fundamental failure of American domestic policy to wean the country off of petroleum, or more generally, to think about economic development in more sustainable terms. History does not tell us exactly how to achieve the independence of American foreign policy from the grip of petroleum hunger, only that it must be achieved if we wish the future to look different from the past. How to get American politics to take up this subject without exploding into partisan chaos is a very big question, but one that must be postponed for another time or for another lecture. A final note about memory as opposed to history. I remember that first feeling on seeing the towers implode. Fear. I was vulnerable. We were all vulnerable to unspeakable horrors that might be visited upon us without warning. And this feeling produced another, anger, indeed rage at those who would commit such an atrocity. And that anger turned into satisfaction even in the heart of a foreign policy dove like me when I saw images of bombs destroying Taliban targets in Afghanistan. If this is how I felt, then most Americans probably exulted even more in the spectacle of revenge, of payback. Those crowds that chanted USA, USA, whenever Bush spoke about the victory over terrorists, must have felt a kind of unity and exultation that ordinary people seldom experience in everyday life. Well, maybe, perhaps, when the Steelers or the Packers or the Patriots win the big one, or when the U.S. hockey players take the Olympic gold, we experience something like it, but really it's not the same. As historians have shown over and again, war is the health of the state. It brings solidarity to fractured polities, forges a sense of common purpose, and a sense of higher purpose, of noble purpose, that's hard to get and hard to get over. It's not going too far to say it's a little addictive. Breaking our addiction to oil will be difficult. Breaking our addiction to the enthusiasms of war may be just as hard. Learning to live in a world of limits and limited policy options will not come easily to a nation accustomed to congratulate itself on being the last best hope of mankind, the arsenal of democracy, and the indispensable nation. Those are all quotes. But history can help a little in this. However, mostly this is the work of citizens, not scholars. We are all in this together.
You spoke a lot about how historians view 9/11, and there seem to be contradictory, varied views of that. Could you speak a little bit about how you come out on it and which of those views you might align your thinking with?
Yeah. Well, I think that what's called blowback often by historians is a major story that historians need to tell the American people and the American people need to absorb. I think one of the fatal errors of American foreign policy in the Cold War era that we have partly learned to avoid, but not fully by any means, was our willingness to ally American power and prestige with some of the most unseemly dictators in the world. And part of the revenge that so many in Iran, for example, felt at the United States, revenge stoked by maniacal, clerical fanatics. But some of that hatred of the United States came because we had conspired to overthrow a democratic government whose only offense had been to discuss the possibility and begin taking action to nationalize the oil resources of Iran, to take it back from Anglo and American international corporations. Now, that one can argue the pros and cons of that nationalization of oil, but it's very hard to argue that overthrowing this democratic person was preferable to what came later, which was a hugely dictatorial regime of the Shah, and then the massive reaction against that regime, which was the Ayatollah Khomeini. We've done that over and over again in many places, not just in the Middle East, of course, in Latin America and places in Asia. And we have to learn, as much as sometimes reality requires us to have strange bedfellows, that's inevitable. In World War II, we had to ally with the second worst dictatorship in history, Stalin's, in order to fight Hitler. So sometimes history forces really, really unlovely choices on us. But we did it too often, we did it unnecessarily in the Cold War era, and we have to wean ourselves from that, in my opinion.
You referred early on in your comments to Pearl Harbor, which many people have over the 9/11. So what did we learn, or how did we learn to react in the post-9/11 period? Lessons from Pearl Harbor or other historical events that are of similar magnitude that have affected us so strongly?
Well, I think we've taken bad lessons, false lessons from Pearl Harbor. We've also taken some good lessons for some of the things we did. One of the few things I can say I congratulate George Bush for is that immediately after the attacks and often thereafter, he regularly told the American people, we are not at war with Islam. This is not the work of Islam. This is the work of fanatics, of a particular organization of fanatics. And that was a noble and proper learning of the lesson of what we did to the Japanese in World War II, what we did to the Germans in World War I. So I can say that even people whose political instincts I find to be largely baneful. I don't like them. Even in people who I find to be on the wrong side of many issues, like George Bush, his response to the internal domestic possibilities of hatred being directed against a religious group, his response was admirable. And so that's a lesson we learned over the decades following the internment of the Japanese, that Ronald Reagan learned and Bill Clinton learned and George Bush learned. We all learned it. So that's a good lesson. I think we learned bad lessons from Pearl Harbor. We learned the lesson that in any foreign policy conflict, in any situation of tension, the thing to fear most is quote-unquote appeasement. It was true, we appeased Hitler. The Allies appeased Hitler, did not act swiftly and forcefully enough against him, thought they could somehow cajole him, negotiate with him, and that was a false assumption based on a false analysis of who he was and what he stood for. But Vietnam was not Europe in the 1930s, and we behaved in Vietnam according to a logic that said, if you appease, and we could never quite decide, was it the Russians or the Chinese? If you appease the Russians, appease the Chinese in this expansionist move into Southeast Asia, you will reap the whirlwind. In fact, it was a very different set of circumstances. And so we had to unlearn what we thought was a lesson of the Second World War, that negotiation with people we did not like was always a bad idea. You had to react forcefully, and you had to treat them as if they were aggressors who could only be stopped with military violence. So I don't know what lessons we're going to take from 9/11. Certainly the Iraq war should teach us several about, first of all, not questioning intelligence that was, to the eyes of many, many people, inherently unreliable. There are many lessons we might learn. But from World War II, we learned some good lessons and some bad lessons.
Thank you. Here's a question. It seems definite to me that the most personally traumatic public event I experienced was the killing of John Kennedy. I was in my early 20s in 1963. Does this seem callous to you? Would you please compare the size of the historical consequence of the Kennedy assassination to those of the Twin Towers disaster?
Well, you don't have to feel guilty about that. I mean, the psychological pain of an event and historical significance of event don't have to be comparable. They don't have to be parallel. I actually felt the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy even more forcefully than the assassination of John Kennedy, and maybe psychologically even more than the 9/11 attack. For me, it was the end of a kind of period of hopefulness about American politics, the ending of those who showed some capacity to span divisions and lead to a better future. But these questions of psychological pain aren't the same as questions about the historical significance and the lasting consequences of an event. The assassination of Kennedy certainly had lasting consequences, but nothing of the consequences of Pearl Harbor, nothing comparable, or even nothing comparable to the consequences of 9/11. 9/11, excuse me, led to two wars. Assassination of John Kennedy led to some, maybe people might say it led to Vietnam, because Kennedy would have been smart enough, clever enough, to back off of Vietnam before it became the quagmire that LBJ got us into. So that's conceivable. But still, even if that's true, that historical consequence and our psychological pain at losing someone we saw as a hero are two very different things. Nothing wrong with having that psychological feeling for Kennedy. That's perfectly right. The same one I have for his brother.
And your title, 9/11, in History and Memory, or Memory and History, could you comment a little bit about the relationship between history and memory, and it sort of interesting looking back to other historical events? How much of those are memory?
Yeah.
Where's the line?
Well, there are a number of ways of looking at this. There's a lot of work in recent decades. Kate Mooney, who I think is out there in the audience, has just about completed her PhD at Yale, studying with David Blight, who used to be our colleague here at Amherst, and who very famously has written on the subject of history and memory. And it can mean a number of things. I mean, in David's hands, it's a very subtle exploration of the way in which Americans conjured the past in writing, but also in parades and memorials and statues and poems and all sorts of things. And the way in which those imaginative reconstructions shape generations of people's attitudes. In his case, it was toward the Civil War and Reconstruction. One might say also that history is the corrective of memory. I mean, we need historians because our memory is lousy. Memory is the most faulty of, it's a wonderful human skill. Most animals have very limited memory. We have tremendous capacity for memory, but even so, it's very weak skill. We know that, for example, we're coming to learn that nothing is more unreliable in criminal trials than eyewitness testimony. Mm. People think they remember that man, and DNA shows it could not possibly have been that man. People think they remember all sorts of things, and we can show that we can easily slip suggestions in, sometimes totally inadvertently, that make them believe they remember. So memory is very faulty. History, of course, is faulty. It's a human practice, a human enterprise that suffers from all the weaknesses that human enterprises suffer from. But it's long and well armored against some more obvious kinds of failure. It has very well practiced and perfected protocols to try to make sure that through a variety of ways of checking documentary sources, and we correct memory, that we write the story of the past in a way that builds on memory but corrects for its inevitable failures and weaknesses. So the relationship between history and memory is it's complicated.
You commented early on in your remarks as well, quoting the sort of perception that everything is different, and that at a policy level and a practice level, there are many people who will say that it's not, but yet I think the sort of average citizen would probably say everything is different post 9/11. So what does that statement mean to two different groups of people?
You may be right, but I'm not sure that's what the average citizen would say. I think right now, if you ask average citizen what's on their mind, 9/11, we happen to have just passed a memorial moment, a 10-year memorial moment. But if you ask them in this time of severe economic trouble, what's primarily on their mind, it's not 9/11. It's not the war on terror. That may be because the war on terror is going pretty well right now. You know, Osama bin Laden has been killed. The terrorist networks appear to be in retreat, or at least under severe stress. But I think it's more that the moment is gone, and we're worried now about other things, jobs and the like. More important than that, I think, Americans have always historically shown themselves to have limited patience for war. The wars that hold up best, that remain quote-unquote popular, that retain support of the population, are those which seem the most absolutely unavoidable, ones that were brought upon us and that we have no choice but to respond to, World War II being most obvious. You know, we were attacked. We were fighting great dictatorships, evil dictatorships, unambiguously evil dictatorships. We had to fight for our survival, for the survival of everything we thought was decent and good in the world. But wars that are fought in more ambiguous circumstances, especially ones that drag on for long periods of time without decisive conclusions, Americans have regularly turned against, whether it was Korea, whether it was Vietnam, whether it's Iraq. Whatever your judgment as to the propriety of the initial entry into those, the rationales for those, the longer they hang on, the less likely Americans want to support them. It's not so much because we're isolationists, although that's one way of seeing it. We're a big country. We're self-sufficient in many ways for well over a century. We did not have to pay very much attention to the world out there. And so built into American politics, and especially into the kind of electoral system we have with the House of Representatives representing individual districts with local parochial interests being foremost in the voters' minds, the political system reinforces our tendency to look at politics as the disposition of issues that we understand and that are closer to us, to our material interests. Much harder, we have a much harder time keeping foreign policy issues firmly in the center of our interest. When a war like World War II comes, it's there in the center of our interest. But if a war lingers too long, it's very hard to convince Americans, especially if it's in a faraway place that we don't understand, in which the locals are not throwing flowers at the tanks as they come through the streets in liberation, but throwing Molotov cocktails at the tanks as they pass through the streets. Americans aren't happy. And I think that, so I think there's a lot of reason to believe that Americans aren't still enamored of 9/11 the way they were, that is the wars that came out of 9/11, the way they were in the early years.
Would you comment on the U.S. Take on 9/11 versus the international perspective? And it may not be fair because international captures a lot of other countries, but you know, how different are those views?
Well, I think most of our allies pull back from whatever minimal support they had offered to the American enterprise in Iraq. Most of them had, and indeed most Arab governments and the Arab street, there were demonstrations in support of the United States. We have to remind ourselves, after 9/11, demonstrations all over the Muslim world, in Indonesia, Syria, in all sorts, in Egypt, in support of the United States and against the actions of the 9/11 terrorists. And all of our allies were instantly supportive. So the Iraq, Afghanistan counterattack against the terrorists was seen by many, or against the Taliban, who was shielding the terrorists, seemed to many to be justified. Iraq was never popular, never supported in any significant way by most of our allies, although Blair offered support, which ended his political career. And there was some support from Italy and a few other countries. But most of it was modest and grudging and quickly withdrawn once it became apparent that we had gotten into a briar patch and were really not going to be able to effect any quick victory.
I was hoping we'd have a little time to hear a little bit more about the two courses you're teaching this semester, your drugs and history and the embodied self. And the drugs and history you've been teaching a while.
I've been teaching that for about 10 years now.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I created that course with Jerry Himmelstein in the sociology department, who teaches an upper division advanced course in sociology called Drugs in Society. And we got together and created this course, and it was designed to look at drugs in the largest possible drug use, in the largest possible perspective possible, the largest lens possible. So we included in our definition of drugs all mood-altering substances, not just those that are the subject of the quote-unquote war on drugs, but legal, illegal drugs, prescription drugs, everything, tobacco. And we went back into history as far as the Middle Ages. And the course really goes to the introduction of Asian spices into the European world, followed very quickly by tobacco and coffee and tea, which radically change the nature of European sense of the self and the possibilities of altering the self's mood in response to the consumption of substances of one kind or another, some of which are in fact addictive, others not, but all of which affect a self's sense of its well-being in some way or another. The students are shocked to learn about the incredible impact of coffee on the modernizing world in the 18th century especially. And then we look at the more obvious drugs, the industrialization of alcohol and the production of tens of thousands of drunkards in the 19th century as a result of the industrialization of the production of distilled alcohol especially, and the rise of the temperance movement. We do the prohibition. We look at length at the war on drugs. But we do things like we read Brave New World and look at dystopian imaginings of a world that at least is partly governed by drugs that sedate people's rebellious or non-conforming behaviors. We look at the crack epidemic, and we look at the way in which drug panics emerge. The crack epidemic being one of the most outrageous examples of a relatively small event on the drug horizon that got turned into a kind of, the Persians are at the gates, the end of life as we know it. Almost all of the panic of which was jerry-rigged, very small amounts of it being a serious problem. So we look at all kinds of things. We read Listening to Prozac and talk about the use of prescription mood-altering drugs and the debate still going on just right now in the New York Review of Books in the last issue, a major set of critical essays by Marcia Engel, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, on the over-prescription of antidepressants and other prescription drugs and the conspiracy between the drug companies and the psychiatrists to push drugs bad enough on adults but on children in huge numbers, off-label in ways that were never approved by the FDA. So these debates are raging. These are not just academic debates. And the students tear into them with gusto. Anyway, it's a good course.
Good. And could you tell us a little bit about the Embodied Self course?
Yeah, the Embodied Self is a course that Alan Gutmann primarily took the leading role in designing. You know, he's a great historian and sociologist of sport, and therefore is very much interested in the way in which the body is imagined and figured and painted and narrated, especially in terms of sport, but more generally. And so he designed this course and asked me to join him, and I added some of my own ideas, but it's mainly his. But it's a great course, and it looks at all sorts of questions on how a society, in this case American society, thinks about the body and the relationship between the self, something we often think of as psychological and mental terms, and the body, which we sometimes think of as the sort of bearer of the self or the container of the self. But as we learn over and over in the class, it's very hard to separate the self as a psychological and mental entity from the body as a physical entity. And so we do many things. We look at art and the way in which the body is portrayed by all sorts of artists, Copley and Aikens and the like. We read about anorexia and about abortion controversies, about the control of the body, whether it's a kind of exaggerated pathological self-control in anorexia, or the threat of an external control of the law over a female's body. We look at imaginings of the extent to which control over the body or lack of control over the body is a fundamental problem for a society. We read The Awakening by Kate Chopin about I can't summarize all the books, but about a late 19th century, early 20th century woman who feels that her body, herself, is not her own, and chooses in the end suicide, rather melodramatic ending, but the issues raised in that book about who controls oneself and what is oneself, and can one have a free self, a free mind, a free psyche, when one's body is not free. We read Hemingway, we read Walt Whitman, that's coming up very soon, The Song of Myself, which is one of the greatest poems ever written. Every time I teach it, I get excited, my students get excited. And we talk about the ways in which in the 19th century there was this sort of revolution, this rebellion against the sense of the body as the sort of enemy of morality and the enemy of truth and the enemy of spiritual good. Whitman is one of those who yells as loud as he can, "That's not true! The body and the mind are all part of a mystical unity." So, we do many things. It's what an American Studies course does. I sometimes say we come up with a topic and then we throw things at it. And this is just the kind of course it is. We throw Hemingway at it, and we throw Whitman at it, and we throw studies of abortion and anorexia at it, and we throw paintings at it, and films like Raging Bull and Personal Best at it. And we see what sticks. So it's fun.
Well, with the American Studies and the history, you have the interesting mix, and I think the American Studies curriculum at Amherst is somewhat unique. Yes, there aren't too many similar. Could you comment a little bit about the American Studies? And I like your idea if you throw something and see what sticks.
Yeah, there are some American Studies programs. American Studies programs are scattered all over the country. They're contracting in number, not dramatically, but contracting in number. Mount Holyoke, among other places, ended its American Studies program. University of Pennsylvania used to have a very famous American Studies department, and a decade ago closed that department. So there is some shrinkage in the field, and partly because it's successful. It was the first truly widespread interdisciplinary field. And it, in some ways, taught the academy how to break out of narrow disciplinary modes, historians doing political and diplomatic history, and English lit scholars doing textual criticism, no contextual work, and the like, and art historians doing picture analysis and iconography. And so it taught people to come together and look at something as complicated as a society, a culture, a civilization, from many perspectives, too complicated to comprehend by a single disciplinary perspective. And so our success has also meant that there's an inevitable shrinkage now as dozens of interdisciplinary departments and programs proliferate all around us. When I arrived here, there was a relatively dormant Black Studies program, and there was a very small European Studies program, and almost nothing else. Now we have a vibrant Black Studies program, a still existing European Studies program, a Black Studies program, an Asian Studies program, a Women's Studies program, environmental science, neuroscience. I mean, you can barely turn around and not bump into an interdisciplinary program at Amherst now. And so, to some degree, that lessens the appeal of American Studies and moves people out into other fields that are sort of at the margins connected to American Studies. But we remain at Amherst fairly strong program. We get good enrollments. We had to put on a third section of a course this fall that was way over enrolled and had to find someone to teach a third section. Students like they're sort of classic liberal arts classes. We read interesting things and we sit around a table and talk about it. And that's what we do at Amherst College in the humanities and social sciences and plenty of the science courses as well. So the department is in good shape, but it doesn't have, there are a few American Studies programs around the country that have a kind of more theoretically assertive identity. Amherst College has always been eclectic and not too pushy about approaches. People take different approaches. We're sort of a big tent department. And I think we like it that way. We're going to have a departmental self-study and a visiting committee this year to look at it and talk about the future and how we're going to evolve. And there'll be lots of discussion about the character of the department and where we're going and what our identity is. But I think we're going to remain pretty happy being an eclectic big tent department.
Oh, and we have another question. The American Studies has gotten people thinking. Are the current American Studies courses you described in the model of such courses in the same day at Amherst? The research was done by our teachers. We were supplied the documents to analyze and comprehend. Do students now have to do pretty much their own research, or do you emphasize the comprehension of the documents? So this was the old original American.
Yeah, no, I think there's still a great deal of continuity. We do a lot of original documents. I mean, our students begin this course by reading Marcel Mauss, the French anthropologist, and Benjamin Franklin, and Benjamin Rush, and Thoreau. I mean, that's how we begin. We begin by looking at the words of people who were there at a particular moment and said things about our subject that's relevant to our students. And we require them to go back and recover that sense of a subject that has a history to it. In the best way you can do that, which is to read the original document. So that's still
very
our
similar.
Yeah, very similar. Yes. Still our approach. Yeah.
Well, this conversation reminds us why we all want to return to the Amherst classroom, and we thank you very, very much for not only the comments on 9/11, the history and memory, but also for sharing some of the coursework you're doing and talking about the departments, which are of interest to all of us.
Thank you all, and any of you who I forgot to mention earlier, email me. I'd love to chat with you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to you joining us for the next call.